to order. It is 12:30, right on the nose, according to resource time. We have invited several of the committees to join us today, but to make sure that we do everything right, I'd like a roll call on the resource committee.
Representative
Kastner.
Representative Gatto.
Here.
Representative Crawford. Representative Seaton.
Here.
Representative Review. Representative Olson.
Here.
Representative Samuels.
Here.
Representative Bremer.
Here. And we have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to also thank the chairman of the Finance Committee. We invited him. Representative Meyer, chairman of the Oil and Gas Committee, is with us. Representative Korn, you're welcome to join us. And I don't see Representative Wyrock, the chairman of Ways and Means. All members will be, I'm sure, welcome to join us. Obviously, the purpose of the meeting today is to begin the discussions on the oil tax reform, on the PPT that the governor has proposed. And with that, with no further ado, Commissioner Corbis, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Bill Corbis. I'm the Commissioner of Revenue. We are here today to speak on behalf of House Bill 488, which is the first major oil and gas tax legislation that has been pursued by administration since 1989. The profit-based production tax, or PPT. The governor has introduced this bill, and he and his administration strongly support it. The bill will replace the existing ELF-based severance tax, which is a broken system. It will encourage badly needed investment in oil and gas exploration, development, and production. It will provide special incentives for emerging Alaskan small companies, explorers, etc., and it will enhance state revenues, particularly during periods of high oil prices. Severance tax reform has been under study for a long period of time, beginning with the prior administration. Dr. Pedro Van Mieres was originally engaged in 1996 to look at this matter. Immediately after taking office, this administration started working on this issue. Today, we are finally ready to roll out the PPT. We have 3 days of hearings scheduled before your committee. You will be hearing from Commissioner of Resources, Mike Mangy, Robin Wilson, Director of the Tax Division, Department of Revenue, Dr. Pedro Van Mieres, consultant and petroleum economist, via conference call from Rome, Italy, Chuck Logsdon, former chief petroleum economist for the Department of Revenue and now a consultant for the state of Alaska, Roger Marks, Department of Revenue petroleum economist, Dan Dickinson, former director of the tax division and now a consultant for the state, and Rob Mintz, assistant attorney general of Division of Oil and Gas in the Department of Law. I would like to acknowledge a number of other people that have been involved in this process could not appear before you today, but Deputy Commissioner of Revenue Steve Porter, Dr. Michael Williams, Chief of the Economic Section, Tax Division, Dick Tremaine, economist. Sherry Nienheis, economist. Mark Graber, auditor. Randy Hoffbeck, state assessor. And Jerry Burnett, director of Administrative Services Division for the Department of Revenue. Again, this is a historic piece of legislation which this administration has introduced. We encourage its enactment. Are there any questions at this time?
Thank you. I'd like to start with, mentioned this on the floor and in meetings with legislators, but the agenda, Ms. Wilson will go through the agenda for the next 3 days for the administration. For the next couple of weeks, what we're going to try to do is the administration will have 3 days to present the bill. If we run out of time at the end of 3 days, because they're going to have to give the same presentation to the Senate Resources Committee every afternoon that follows us, we will roll that into Saturday. Saturday we're having public testimony. If the administration needs some time to finish out, we'll do that on Saturday. Monday and Tuesday we have invited the three major producers to present. I don't have the exact times yet for Monday and Tuesday. Wednesday we've invited the explorers, and I haven't contacted all of them yet, but been trading phone calls with the explorers. Next Friday and Saturday we'll try to get presentations from legislative consultants Econ One and Daniel Johnston. Those times probably noon sometime, but we're still working on some of the details of that. And so that's the agenda that we've got going forward so far. And I'd like to introduce the legislators in the room. We have on the Resources Committee Representative Crawford and Kapsner have joined us, and in the audience the Chairman of the Oil and Gas Committee, Representative Coring. We have Representative Hawker, Gardner, Moses, Newman, Dahlstrom, Wilson, Grunberg, McGuire, Holm, Chairman of the Rules Committee, Rookford, introduced to members here, Representative Petula, Eric Guttenberg, Jewell, and the rest have been introduced as members of the Resource Committee. And I guess the big question that I've got that I've been asked by reporters and probably quite a few people in this room is, publicly, the administration came out with a 25-20, with 25% tax and 20% tax credit. And then since that public announcement, there have been substantive changes, but the one that's most public right now is going from 25 to 20. So just generally speaking, I realize we're going to get into the details of all of this on days two and three, but generally speaking, without getting into the details, why the drop from 25 to 20?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In early February, Dr. Pedro Van Mures made a presentation to the joint finance committee and analyzed a whole range of tax rates and tax credit schemes. As a result of his analysis, he ultimately recommended a 25% tax rate and a 20% investment credit rate. Earlier this week, we had meetings with the producers, and we ultimately decided on an acceptable 20% tax rate, 20% investment rate that was acceptable to both parties. The administration felt that this was in the range of reasonableness compared to other regimes around the world, and that's how we arrived at that. Dr. Van Mures, who will be testifying before you tomorrow, can address that issue in more depth if it's the committee's pleasure.
Okay, and I'm sure that question will come up. Representative Kapsner.
On that point, earlier this year, the governor said that the tax would be retroactive to January 1st, and in the current version, we don't see that.
Through the chair, Representative Casper, that's correct. The effective date that we have before you in House Bill 488 is July 1st, 2006.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, I think that reflects a $500 million figure if it's 20%. $750 million if it's 25%.
I'm sure the question will also get asked once we get into the nuts and bolts of it. Any questions for Commissioner Corbis on more big picture issues? Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn this over to Commissioner of Resources Mike Menge, who is going to explain how the PPT fits within other administration initiative to fully develop Alaska's oil and gas and the role that they see it playing in our vision for the future. Commissioner Menge.
Thank you, Commissioner Corbis. For the record, my name is Michael Menge. I'm the Commissioner Designate for the Department of Natural Resources. As in most things in life, my notes that I prepared for this day immediately are worthless, so I'm not even going to bother to open my book. Chairman Samuels, the issue that you brought up, the change from 25 to 20, it gets right at the heart of what we're going to have to deal with collectively over the next weeks. There are policy calls, and the impact and the results of those policy calls and situations like this cannot truly be measured for decades yet to come. The best we can do is we bring our very best people together, we draw upon their years and decades of experience, and we try to construct a future and anticipate what we can do, the foundation we can lie, that will actually allow that future to come true. There are some things that we can deal with, some realities that we can deal with. This was at the heart of the governor's decision to move that to balance what he believed is an appropriate return for the state of Alaska in return for investment by the oil and gas companies. We have to take into consideration not only the large oil companies, the big three, but we have to take into consideration the entire gamut, the entire spectrum of companies from small to large. We have to think about the circumstances that we deal with now, the realities we'll deal with in Alaska. Our big elephants have been found, at least on state lands. We're looking at an increasing number of smaller and smaller prospects that, frankly, the large companies are simply not going to be interested in developing. We're talking about the 100 to 150 million barrel fields. Those are going to are targets that the mid-size and smaller companies go after with great vengeance. In the Lord's infinite wisdom, we hope that in so gathering that data, we uncover or we unlock a new secret up there, and we actually do find additional large fields. It is an incredibly remote and large area, and we simply do not know what lies beneath the surface. We simply have a collection of our best guesses pulled together. But what will lead us in that direction, which will ultimately unlock those secrets, if in fact they exist up there, is additional drilling, additional exploration, and bright young people that are home playing video games now, which in the fullness of time will graduate from engineering schools, geology schools, and will have an opportunity to apply their wisdom to the North Slope and to our other fields across Alaska. The governor's proposal sets a balance that allows us to deal with what we do know today, which is the development that's going on in Prudhoe and Kuparuk, which lies in Point Thompson, but also sets a stage to incent smaller and mid-sized companies to step out and make the investments to do the exploration that will ultimately lead us to the solutions into the future of Alaska. There are two main things that we have to keep in mind. And again, I'm going to try to put this in larger context, because it is within that context that the value of the decisions that we make must be judged. On any one specific given point, you can drill down and you can be quite critical, and you may justifiably be critical, but you really have to back off and see how that particular point interacts with a thousand other points across the spectrum for oil and gas exploration. There are two major benefits that we hope to create in this historic undertaking that all of us are embarking upon today. The first is we want to have the smaller, mid-sized companies out there doing exploration. The benefit from that will come in years down the road. There will be discoveries made. There will be additional oil that otherwise would not have been produced, sent down the pipeline. Good Lord willing, we'll have our gas line, and there will be a gas pipeline the results of these companies. We'll also send a lot of additional gas down the pipeline. This is not an immediate benefit to the state. The immediate benefit obviously comes in the activities related to the royalties and the production taxes. The benefits that we can garner immediately. But the true benefit lies in the future with the increased investment. I can tell you right now the decisions that Representative Roper put in motion that I carried through today dealing with the GURIC and the royalty relief. There are 70 people working right now at this very moment on the North Slope that are bringing home paychecks and buying candy bars and bunny boots and making a net contribution to society. Next year, that number will grow to several hundred. Again, additional. This will not, a single penny will not have come to the state of Alaska. But I would venture to say that the net benefit to society does not necessarily pass through the state treasury. There are many, many additional benefits that the state accumulates by virtue of it providing an investment scene that encourages small and mid-sized companies to step out. And in the fullness of time, we will see the results of that. You cannot create oil and gas out of goodwill and intentions. You have to get out there and drill holes and weld pipe together and work on this issue. That then leads to the discoveries that puts the oil in there. And the royalties in the tax proposal that we laid before you today, the royalties are unaffected, and that's where the real meatball is. That's where the real benefit comes to us down the road. Yes, we hope that we will garner additional production taxes, and certainly the commissioner and the Department of Revenue and all of the experts gathered for the next 3 days will go through that in agonizing detail for you. But keep in mind, all of this is in the context of what we have to deal with. We have basins within the interior of Alaska, the Nana Basin, Copper River Basin, Fort Yukon, goes on and on and on. Geologically, these are stressed basins, the geologic history of Alaska, because of the fact we have a lot of hard rock minerals and gold, silver. Those do not exist. They're not friendly neighbors with oil and gas. They are different geologic histories and thermal regimes. But that does not mean that the temperatures were so high that all of the hydrocarbon was destroyed. But people will not go into these basins unless there is a reasonable opportunity to recoup their investment. So it's very important for us to set a economic scene that allows that kind of exploration to take place. We have a mature basin in Cook Inlet that is also a diminishing amount of prospects, but are critically important to bridge the gap until we can bring North Slope gas into the bowl. So we have to incent activity out there. We have an emerging basin on the Alaska Peninsula. Again, high risk, potentially high reward. But these are not for the faint of heart. We simply have to encourage people to step out. So all of these things are wrapped up in what you're seeing presented to you today. It is in within that context that we would ask you to measure and value and judge what's being presented. If you ultimately put blinders on and simply hone in on specific issues, you will find plenty there to work with. But I would suggest that you will have lost the intention, certainly the governor's intention, and his decision to move to a 2020 was with the blinders off, looking at the entire spectrum of opportunities that are presented to us geologically across the state, and the benefit that Alaska will garner over the years if we encourage the companies to move out into these risky areas and make the initial investments, drill the holes, and hopefully find the gas. Certainly the Nanana Basin is one that's really exciting right now. The first well that was drilled out there encountered very high pressure areas of gas, but it was also challenged because of a large shale section, which created tremendous complications, and it required that the drillers do some exotic things to maintain the integrity of the well, but in so doing, shaded or shadowed the real geologic information there. But it's enough to encourage them to go back. And if a discovery is made, imagine what that will mean for Fairbanks in that area. But these are millions and millions of dollars that have to go out on the roll of the dice. We are trying to provide the incentives for them to roll those dice. But as I've often talked to this committee and others before, it will be a partnership. And partners respect each other's roles and responsibilities. We intend to get a return for our investment. This is not charity. They have to carry through with their part, we carry through with our part. We will, if they are successful, garner benefit beyond the initial investment. If they don't find anything, well, at least we will have looked. And that's really the important thing here. Geologically speaking, all we can do is stare at the top of the table. We have no concept of what lies below it until we drill that hole in the ground. You are faced with the same degree of responsibility. You're presented with an array of data here today and over the next 3 weeks, and you will be bombarded with information until ultimately you make the decisions on how you want to proceed. But you have an imperfect crystal ball to gaze into. It's clouded with uncertainty, and it stretches forward in time decades. So you are ultimately going to have to make decisions based on the very best information you have. My dad taught me before I left in seeking my fortune that, son, you do the best you can with what you got and the time you got to do it. And that's what we're going to have to do here. We hope to bring to bear some very, very strong resources to aid you in those decisions. And I know, Representative Samuels, you have also, through LBNA, pulled together some tremendous talent, which will also assist you. But at the end of the day, like the governor, you're going to have to make a decision on what's best for the state of Alaska. If you make that decision on the best you can get over the next 6 months or the next year or 2 years, you will not have taken into consideration the intention of the legislation that we lay before you, because it does not just deal with this year or next year. It deals with the next decade and the decade after that, and generations of Alaskans yet to be born. If we can land this tax change and change the world view of Alaska, you're going to see people coming here from all over the world making investments, and those investments will bear results. We have a tremendous geologic profile to work with. I haven't talked about the federal acreage, but certainly NPRA, offshore, the ADWAR, tremendous opportunities there that we will all benefit from. So this legislation, in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, this legislation sets the stage for a very broad context to develop and enhance Alaska's oil and gas future. It is not designed specifically to extract the maximum amount of benefit that can be extracted in the short term. It is designed to present a balance that takes into consideration all the things I've talked about and many additional things which we can continue to talk about if you choose to, to develop that information better. So I urge the committees and the legislature to look at this from a broad perspective. Yes, the details are important, and yes, the specific questions that I've heard asked and will be asked many times are important, and good answers are deserved. But you have to take the answers you get and put it into the landscape of the issue that we're dealing with. And if you do that, I am confident that you will arrive at the right conclusion for the state of Alaska. I have worked with many legislators in my life, both federal and state, and I'm absolutely impressed with the seriousness with which I see the membership of this body taking on this challenge. It is truly historical, and all of us will write our names in the charter of history. Either way, however we act, people will look back on this and they will say it was a tremendous challenge they faced, and hopefully in time they will say we did the right thing together, not separately. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have as it relates to the kind of the broad contextual issues.
Thank you, Commissioner Mangy. And are there any questions on, without getting into the specifics on the legislation, which obviously we've got 3 days to go to, but on the big picture issues, Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to try to clear up in my own mind what it is that we're actually looking at and what we're going to be voting on. I've heard several things in the news over the last few days. The governor says that this is a gas line and an oil tax deal that's a package that's an up or down vote. I remember that when we reauthorized the Stranded Gas Act that we were pretty I mean, the language was pretty specific that this was only a gas deal and that, that oil taxes would be separate from that. Are we doing this under the Stranded Gas Act with a simple up or down vote, or is this a separate oil tax deal that, that is open to amendment? What is it that we're dealing with here?
Representative Crawford, that's an excellent question. And let me see if I can lay this out for you in kind of in general terms. I will start by saying the Stranded Gas Act was a historical piece of legislation. It set down the parameters that we've been following, the guidebook that we were asked to use. Two years ago when we started this, I will admit that I was incredibly naive. I thought I was pretty smart. I thought that I understand how oil and gas deals go together and how gas pipelines work. Over time, I have come to learn that the gas pipeline is not an entity alone in a vacuum. It is tied to the oil. It is tied to the state. It is tied to everything. So as we negotiated the gas contract, it became very obvious that we were going to have to deal with oil taxation as well. Imagine a situation where the companies agreed to spend $20 billion to build an infrastructure, and they reach the day where they make the commitments, the orders go in for the pipe, and the price of gas drops, and we sit back as a body here in the state going, not quite as good a deal as we thought. Let's just bring the oil taxation piece in, and let's plump up the oil side so we compensate for the gas side. So then the oil companies are not only taking a beating economically on the pipeline, but they're also threatened significantly on the oil side. If you look at that, they are inextricably linked. But the Stranded Gas Act said very specifically, as you point out, Representative Crawford, that you cannot do this. We were locked on the horns of a dilemma at that point. The oil companies were unwilling to proceed without a recognition of the need for oil certainty. We stepped back. We resisted that for months and months and months. But it became quite obvious that we were not going to get a gas deal until we addressed oil. Because oil was specifically excluded under the Stranded Gas Act, which we were operating, we said this will require a structured approach, and that's going to get to the heart of the question that you've asked. The decision was this oil taxation piece is critically important ultimately to the gas line, but it is so important it touches everyone in the state, every oil and gas producer, every taxpayer, every citizen. We are not authorized to present that to the legislature in an up or down vote. The decision was to come forward as we have yesterday to present a standalone oil legislation. Regardless of the gas line, whether the gas line ever is constructed, the oil piece that you're contemplating now will become the law of the land, and it will control how we manage our oil business for, well, if history is any indication, for at least 20 years or more before we take it up again. So the decision was made to proceed forward through the legislature with a fully amendable oil legislation that would be subject to the full committee process, which we have started today. It is connected, but it's in a sequence, and I'll run through the sequence of connections. The oil thing is done by itself, fully amendable by the legislature. You exercise all of your authorities, and at the end, a product is produced. That product is then set next to the oil legislation. But because we are not authorized to include this within the Stranded Gas Act, we will come to you with a package of amendments to the Stranded Gas Act. So step two, after you pass the standalone oil, will be contemplation of a package of amendments to the Stranded Gas Act. Within that will be an amendment requesting your blessing to attach it to the gas contract. Again, this will be amendable. This will be for the full consideration of the legislature, and you will draw your own conclusions as to whether this is an appropriate thing to do. If, as we hope, you say this is appropriate, you will have passed a piece of historic oil legislation. You will have authorized us to attach it to the gas contract through those amendments, and then we will lay the entire platter before you, that the oil piece is there, that you've already blessed, the ability to connect it to the gas line, which you will ever bless, and the gas contract. And you will contemplate all of this in a single entity, and that is the thing that you will vote up or down on as specified in the Stranded Gas Act. So you have to think of this in a series of steps, which will ultimately lead us to the contemplation of the entire spectrum of issues that will be laid before you. And then, and only then, will you be asked to vote up or down on this. So it will not occur until after the oil legislation has been blessed by you, until you have given us the authority to attach it to the Stranded Gas Act. And then, and only then, will we contemplate this entire package. But understand, this package is ultimately necessary to set the economic environment within which people are prepared to invest $20 or more billion and deal with the uncertainty of the natural gas. We have watched the natural gas prices this year spike because of Katrina and because of shortages. We've watched gas spike, and now it's coming back down. Try to imagine the challenges associated with looking 8 to 10 years into the future and determining what the price of gas is going to be. It is very, very challenging. We think, because of the research that we've done, the world trend economic analysis, and some of the best brains in the world, that we're proceeding forward on a safe course of action. But it is a risk. And therein, the risk requires that the risk reduction is best done through being able to have certainty. And what we will be present, what you will be presented with, is a package of legislation that provides certainty as it relates to taxation. And that will be locked in. That will be one thing that is not subject to the vagaries of time and conscience and circumstance. It's not going to get rid of the risk, but it is going to provide a great deal of certainty. All you have to do is look at the past, because we were a bit guilty of it ourselves when we built the TAPS line shortly after the agreement was made and the money was put out to buy the material. The state of Alaska stepped in and changed the oil taxation, which fundamentally changed the economic picture of the pipeline. Now, luckily, it came at a time when oil prices were going up, and the system was able to absorb that shock. But gas is not oil, and it is more delicate and more subject to fluctuation on the market. So it does not have the robust ability to accept shock like oil does. So that's the reason that we've taken this course of action. I believe it is absolutely necessary, getting a gas pipeline built, but we're doing it in a structured way that allows you to pass judgment on the course of action that we will lay before you. There was great pressure, I can assure you, simply to try to put this into an up or down vote, but all of us that have at least weren't born yesterday recognized the importance of this project to the state of Alaska and the need to run it through the legislative process. That was a rather long-winded explanation, but I hope it helps you understand the context within which we're working and ultimately where it will lead.
And I'd like to follow up on that also is the three-vote scenario. If it gets through the process to a vote, you will vote on oil. You will vote on whether or not you can include oil with gas, and you will vote on the package. There will be consequences to doing. If we don't get to a consensus on oil and take no vote, it will have consequences. If we vote we do not want to include oil with gas, that will have consequences also. And then at the end of the day, you could say, oil is okay, we voted on oil, we think it's okay that oil is attached to gas, but we don't like this particular deal with oil and gas, and you could vote with that too. So there'll be three separate votes in order. So I would encourage all members to make sure, as you look at this particular piece, and right now this is simply a discussion on House Bill 488, a revise of our oil tax system in the state of Alaska. This debate continues for the next weeks as it goes from committee to the floor, in the back of your mind you have to consider this could be a long-term decision, but you cannot base solely your decision on that, because we might be changing the oil tax system and that's all we do this session. And then off we go, and oil deal may never come. We don't know what will happen. You have to keep in mind the road in front of you, how it goes, and the stumbling blocks, the consequences for the yes and the no's on the three big votes. And there will be consequences no matter what we as a body choose to do but make sure you keep in the back of your mind what could happen. But right now, the discussion is on House Bill 488, a revision of oil taxes. And we have a question from Representative Gatto. But I'd like to try to stick into big picture things, because we've got a long ways to go to get nuts and bolts of decisions for 25 and the 20. We have 3 days of that, but Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. A lot of what you just said kind of comes back to my question, and that is, you mentioned that oil legislation is standalone, and you mentioned that gas legislation is standalone. But then you said we're going to combine the two. And the only value I can see in combining the two is that there are links. And is that what you're expecting? There will be links?
At the end of the day, there will, those linkages will occur. I know that you're well-versed in kind of that basic economics. With each decision that this body makes, will result in a specific set of economics. Once you have passed judgment on the oil pipeline, there will be a consequent, and this is along the lines of Chairman Samuel said, there will be a consequential definition of an economic picture. Now, when you make the decision to link the oil piece to the gas, that will redefine the economic picture. It will change it significantly. Ultimately, when you contemplate all three things together, you will have a world of economics that will be defined by all three of those pieces. But you cannot contemplate gas. You can contemplate gas without any of the others. It comes with its own specific economic picture, which may or may not be sufficient to cause the companies to make the investments to build the gas pipeline. So each of these things that you work on and you decide come with a specific economic consequence. As you contemplate one, you contemplate two, and you contemplate three. Those will be three separate economic pictures, and how you mix and match will define what the economics are. But the economics will ultimately drive the decisions to build a gas pipeline or not build a gas pipeline. That is just simply the reality of the world within which we live.
Thank you. Representative McGuire.
Looking for a yes or no answer here.
You're a good woman.
Will the governor veto House Bill 488 should this legislature not choose to adopt the amendments to the Stranded Gas Act?
Representative McGuire, will you allow me two words?
Yes.
Don't know.
The sequence of events will be House Bill 488. Let's assume House Bill 488 at some level passes. The second vote, I don't think, takes place until after the public comment period.
That's it.
So, I don't know, you have to check on the time, but Representative Curtula and then Roper, big picture questions.
I may get the same answer as Representative Carr just got, but you already made an agreement on how the oil piece fits into the gas line contract. And I mean, my problem is, if it's a sequence of events, we almost have to know what the end is we're seeing before we can take step number one.
Commissioner Corbis.
Through the chair, Representative Curtula, we have not completed that portion of our discussions with the producers.
Can you tell me what the issues around this is? I mean, and I'm particularly interested in from hearing a certainty or from that the oil tax may have to last.
Through the chair, Representative Curtula, the exactly how the wording in the contract concerning fiscal certainty on oil has not been determined. Certainly, the House Bill 488 comes out will be important, but it's envisioned that it will be referenced in the contract, and that those will be the terms. That will most of the terms that will go forward, as far as the years of fiscal certainty goes, we're not in a position yet to go public on that issue.
Thank you, Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Member. Commissioner Mangy, for the record, the this legislation, of course, continued tax is a law of general applicability. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct, Representative Roper.
And secondly, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Mayer, you said, if I got your quote correctly, that this particular bill is not designed to extract the maximum benefit in the short term. Given the requirement of our state constitution to maximize the benefits for all Alaska, how do you reconcile those that state?
I think that term, reconcile the benefits of all Alaska, does take the long view. There, it is important to take into, used to call it eating your seed corn. You can have a feast on day one and then starve after that. You have to balance the investment for today for the benefit of tomorrow, and I do believe that that is engendered within that, within your quotation.
Thank you. I think we'll move on now. Ms. Wilson, the director of the tax division, is going to kind of walk through what's going to happen over the next 3 days, and then Mr. Dickinson will start the presentation on the.
Mr. Chairman, may I just
say
a word of introduction of Robin Wilson. First of all, Robin is the director of the tax division, and she will be the official for the state that will be overseeing and implementing House Bill 488. Robin is a CPA, worked for one of the Big Eight accounting firms back in the day, and there were eight of them. Came to work for the state of Alaska Tax Division in 1995 as an auditor. She was appointed in December of 2005 as director of the tax division. Robin herself will be making several presentations and will be introducing the other presenters during the next 3 days. She will be responsible to see that we complete our presentations on schedule and make sure that we do our job before you. So I'm going to turn it over to Robin Wilson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Robin Wilson. I'm the Tax Division Director. I'd like to start out by giving you sort of a roadmap of the next 3 days. First, Dan Dickinson will explain how the current production tax works and some of the problems with the current system, but that will give you a foundation upon which to move forward. Then I will come in and I will give you an overview of the PPT bill before you, and that's meant to be a very general overview to set the context of the next couple of days. When we will get into the real specifics of it. But first, I'd like to give you sort of the 30,000-foot view. And lastly, today I will walk you through the fiscal note to give you that information. And that will probably take care of today. And then tomorrow we will begin to drill down into the details. First, we'll start with the economists. And we have... Dr. Pedro Van Muris will, as previously mentioned, be available telephonically to present his report, and you can ask questions about his report, and he will then describe how this bill will allow Alaska to be competitive internationally. And Roger Marks of our division will come in and explain how the modeling works and details about projections on revenue and price scenarios. We will then move in to the sort of section-by-section analysis, which will be presented by Mr. Dickinson and Assistant Attorney General Rob Mintz. They will go through the bill and explain in detail how it works. That presentation will then probably carry on into the third day, and as part of that presentation, Roger Marks will be discussing how the PPT affects small companies at the pleasure of the chair, and depending on timing. We also have Chuck Logsdon available to discuss the tax theory and why it's an efficient tax. And then at the end, I expect that I'll come back and give sort of a summary. So our plan is to present very broad ideas, drill down to the details, and then come back up and look at it one last time from a general perspective. Now, I know there's going to be a lot of questions, and I expect by the end of the week that we will have answered all of them. But I would ask that you hold most of your questions for when we get into the details tomorrow and Friday. Today, we are really doing sort of an umbrella approach. Now, obviously, to the extent that either Dan or I are not clear on our presentation, you know, please feel free to ask us questions of clarification. With that, I'd like to introduce Mr. Dickinson. He is the immediate past tax division director. He is a certified public accountant and a certified management accountant, and he currently serves as consultant to the governor's office on tax matters. Thank you.
Hey, before you start, Dan, if the legislators are sitting in the front, if you get a better view from over here looking at that, you are more than welcome to move around to this side of the room or whatever you want to do. Okay, Dan, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dan Dickinson. Today, I'd like to take the first shot at coming and speaking to you about some of the more of the specifics about HB 488. This is a bill that, in one form or another, or set of ideas that I've had the pleasure to wrestle with and address many of you before. The first slot I'm supposed to be talking about is trying to talk about why the current system is broken and why that leads us to this solution. For those of you who wondered, the PPT is obviously stands for the Proposed Production Tax, as the slide suggests there. But what I'd like to do to start out is by just orienting us to where the PPT or where the production tax sits overall in terms of Alaska's fiscal picture. What I've done here is pulled out a bunch of facts from the Department of Revenue's sources book. I'm sure you all know it well. It's a place it's a book I highly recommend. And if we look there, we see last year, FY05, the state brought in $8.9 billion in revenues. Of those, the largest piece was oil, but a very large piece comes from investment, $2.8 billion. Another $1.9 comes from the federal government. And then areas that lots of us spend lots of our time dealing about, lots of little pieces, all get summed up under that famous rubric of other for $800 million. But the largest piece is $3.4 billion in revenues from oil and gas. Of that, and this is not on the slide, but of that, 2.8 of that was unrestricted. And so if you that constitutes 88% of the unrestricted dollars in. Turning to the next slide, let me focus in a little bit more on what those oil and gas revenues look like. The largest piece by far are royalties, and those constitute the two wedges that you see on top. As you're probably aware, 25% of the royalties go to the permanent fund or the public school fund. The rest form the single largest piece in the general fund expenditures at $1.4 billion. Over on the right-hand side, you will see, the NPRA. Those should have been the restricted, so all colors are a little off there, but I don't think that will upset the general picture that we're viewing here. What you see are the portions of the property taxes that the state receives, so the special oil and gas property tax, the special oil and gas corporate income tax, and the very last wedge on the bottom is the production tax, and that's what we're focusing in on today. So as you can see, that year it was roughly $860 million. This year, if prices continue where they are in our forecast, it will be something north of $1 billion. It's a large piece of the total picture. It is not the largest piece. Turning to the next slide, this is a slide, again, I think folks are very familiar with, and I think it bears looking at time and time again as you look at the future and look at what's happening in Alaska oil and gas. This is a production tax. What you see here is where Alaska's oil productions come from. The orange area of the graph is Prudhoe Bay. Prudhoe Bay was a huge elephant field, still is by comparison to many other places, but its elephant days, if you will, are over. When in 1988, the state of Alaska produced 2 million barrels of oil a day, 1.6 of those came from Prudhoe Bay. Kuparuk, on the other hand, is the second largest oil field in the United States. It's the I guess, a different color of orange, slightly above the main Prudhoe Bay area. And as you can see, even being the second largest oil field is very small compared with Prudhoe Bay. The reason this slide is so dramatic and bears looking at is if you look at what's happening on the North Slope, you will see we're getting many, many tiny onion skins, is the word, many tiny areas, new production, new fields are coming on. It would be a vibrant place, and we could talk about expanding production, expanding opportunities, except that it's plotted against a background of declining Prudhoe Bay production. If you remove the baseline and simply plot all these other skins, you'd say things are looking very good on the North Slope. What I think folks tend to focus on, and rightly, is the fact that what's happened is Prudhoe Bay is declining rapidly, and the glory days of production, the 2 million barrels a day, were driven in large part by the easy days of production from Prudhoe Bay. Let me move on to the next, to one last slide to give you just, a grounding here before I move on to the specifics of the PPT. One of the things that has occurred over the last, since 1988, when we were producing 2 million barrels a day, is a decline in production. And if you look at the green line, that is tied to the right-hand axis, that shows you the production, monthly production, from the North Slope. As you can see, since 1988 through today, it's basically been marching down, some months up, some months down. Those of you who are economists can actually pick a seasonal trend out there, but fundamentally, it has been marching down. Less easy to see, perhaps, because there have been more ups and downs, is the red line. The red line ties to the left-hand axis, and that's the price of ANS on the West Coast. And what's been happening is, as the volume has been falling, the price has been rising. I particularly liked this diagram a couple of years ago. It was fun to present because what you had was a situation where back in 1988, we were producing 2 million barrels a day, but they were worth $15 in the market, versus a time period a couple of years ago when we were only producing 1 million barrels a day, but they were worth 30 in the market. Essentially, the value of the production was the same. Now, even though we're only producing about 850,000 barrels a day, because of the value, because of the price, in fact, the revenues that we're seeing from our production tax, from our royalties, from all our oil and gas measures, are extraordinarily high. But I think what's important is that change in price, and we're going to talk a lot about that price, and a lot about this tax is focused on price issues, shouldn't obscure the underlying continuing decline in production. Well, thank you. Now, as promised, Mr. Chairman, I'm actually going to speak about the PPT. I'm going to talk about the problems with the current production tax. And I'm really going to focus in on three issues here. What is happening to revenues? In other words, how the current production tax is structured and whether we're getting the revenues that we should be. The second thing is the effect of the current production tax on investment. And, of course, if it doesn't have a good effect on investment, that's ultimately going to lead, if there's less investment, you're going to get less production. And then the final step is, of course, if you have less production, you will ultimately have less revenues. So it kind of brings us full cycle. One of the things I want to mention here, and I think Bill Corbis mentioned it as well, we've been looking at production tax issues for 2 years. Many of you will recall about just over a year ago, one of the fruits of looking at that was an administrative decision. And that decision had the effect of aggregating seven fields in the Prudhoe Bay unit into a single unit for purposes of ELF. Assuming that this bill passes, because I hope we can convince you it's a great idea, but assuming this bill passes, that aggregation will have been in effect for roughly 18 months when it's superseded by this bill. In those 18 months, and I did this back in the envelope, I'm pretty sure it's accurate, if prices stay where they are, that aggregation decision will have raised almost $400 million in additional revenue. What I want to focus in there is that we've been looking at these issues as we look at them, or we're acting on them as we can, and as you know, sometimes it takes a while to develop points. what we developed there was part of the study, and what we've developed here is part of what we were looking at. With Dr. Van Meers' work, we've turned it into a very specific proposal. But what you see is part of this ongoing study of trying to look at the production tax and see how it affected revenue, investment, and production. If we look on the North Slope of Alaska now, and we look at the capital spending, this does not include, incidentally, lots of additional dollars that have to be spent to get the oil to market. This doesn't include, for example, the money being spent on tankers. This doesn't include TAPS or the strategic reconfiguration going on in TAPS now. This is just the capital spending on field facilities and exploration, the dollars for exploration and development. Now, what you can see is, and for the last several years, we've been roughly at $1 billion a year, $1 billion a year in investment. Now, tax is not the direct driver behind how much investment is made. And I would never claim it is the ultimate reason that investment gets made or doesn't get made. But I think at the margin, tax policy can have an effect. So what we're trying to do here is create a situation where if those investments, a tax policy would favor making those kinds of investments. How does this bill do that? And I think the important thing to compare is how this bill does it versus why the status quo does not. Let's look for a minute at how those investments fit into the larger picture. Title of the slide, How the World Works. Again, this is just kind of looking at a very big picture, and what I pulled out here was fiscal year 2005. At fiscal year 2005, we were producing a little bit under a million barrels a day, about 960,000 barrels a day. So there were 330 million barrels of oil produced. The average price over that year was $43.43 in the market. So you can see that the ANS from the North Slope was worth about $14 billion on the West Coast when it got delivered there. What did it cost to get it there? Well, you spent about $4.51 a barrel to get it there. And that's basically tankering from Valdez on down to the West Coast and then the TAPS line to get it from Pump Station 1 down to Valdez. Multiply that through, it's about $1.5 billion was spent in the cost to get this oil to market. So what does that do to producer's value? That means at the point of production, when it was removed from the lease, it was worth about $12.8 million. At that point, what did it take to get it off the lease? What did it take to get it to the ground, out of the ground? Well, we can divide that into two pieces. One is the operating cost, which in fact were the cost that it took to get those barrels out. The other one is capital and exploration, and obviously there's a time dimension to capital and exploration, so what we've put in here are the costs that were expended in 2005. Obviously, they would expend them hoping to get a future benefit from them, but I think it just gives you a sense of the dollars being spent and where those dollars come from. So talk about spending about $6.50 to get the oil out of the ground to Pump Station 1, or about another $2 billion. And that gives you the net value at the point of production of those $330 million, of about $11 billion. Now, at that point, say $11 billion, you know, that gets divided up. That's prior to a royalty, so the royalty would be about $1.5 billion that would come to the state. The federal government would look at that and say, "Gee, we'd like about a third of that." So another, you know, $3 billion goes in federal taxes, and the remaining piece is either goes to the producers or is what is hit by our production tax. How would we tax that under the current system? Well, if you look at the $12.8 billion, about halfway down the page, we would take that $12.8 billion. As I said, we'd remove the royalty, which actually it says the royalty rate is 8.75. That'd be very nice. That's actually 1 minus the royalty rate. The royalty rate is about 12.5%. So net of royalty, there's a value there of about $11.2 billion. What we do under the current system, as folks well know, is we took that, the 15% tax rate, times the economic limit factor. And our current economic limit factor is just above half. about 0.55. So we would multiply that $11 billion times 15% times 0.55, and we'd say taxes on this slug of oil in fiscal year 2005 would have been about $927 million. And I know if people look back here and say, wait a minute, it was only 800 and something here, this is meant to be somewhat of an overview, so it's not exactly correct. But that's how our current production tax treated it. Now, the question is, what happened to all that investment? How did this tax recognize the investments on the North Slope necessary to get the oil out of the ground? And the answer is, it didn't recognize them at all. We looked at the gross value at the point of production, and that's what we taxed. We did not create any incentives. We did not, if oil was more expensive, heavy oil, challenged oil was more expensive to get out of the ground, we taxed it exactly the same as if it were the light sweet crude just flowing out of Prudhoe Bay. There's no recognition in the current system here on the slide, as you can see, of the upstream investments. Let me compare that for a minute with what would happen under the proposed PPT. Again, we'd start at the value net of royalty, but now we would allow all those upstream costs as deductions. That includes all the exploration, that includes the cost of the wells, that includes everything to get the oil out of the ground. We would take a deduction for that $2 billion, and you'd end up with the taxable value at the point of production here takes it down to about $9 billion. What we propose is a tax rate of 20%. And for those of you who try to fix PowerPoint slides at the last minute, believe me, it's not that easy. There should be something on the left-hand side that identifies that tax rate at 20%. But that generates tax prior to credits of $1.8 billion. You would then get a credit for the upstream investments that were capital investments. In this case, in 2005, that would have been $1 billion or $1.05 billion, so 20% would have been $210 million. And the production tax would have been, or would be under our proposal, $1.6 billion. I didn't change the slide, but you can compare that. Under the current system, you'd have about a $900 million, and under the proposed system, you'd be at about $1.6 billion. Now, the important thing is that's recognizing the investment. And yet you say, wait, if you recognize the investment but taxes go up, how does that help? I think if you turn to the next page, what I'll say is what happens if, in fact, you did have a huge slug of incremental investment? As an example, just to make it work out nicely, I said, what happens if you had an additional $1.7 billion of investment? We start with that same figure, the production tax net of royalty. We subtract from it the $3.8 billion now, because we've increased our investment by 1.7. So we come up with a taxable value of about 7.3. We multiply that times a tax rate of 20%, and we come out with a tax prior credits of 1.4. You take your credits, which you've now added in that additional $1.7 billion. Your credits come out with $550, and of course, with the magic of my example, our production tax is now exactly where it started. So my point is this. We either get the cash or we get the investment. How it's set up is, if we don't get the investment, it's meant to incentivize the investment. I think as Commissioner Menge so eloquently spoke, what we're looking for is the investment. But if we don't get the investment, we get the cash. The taxes are higher for folks not making investments, lower for folks making investments. The reason the current system is broken is the taxes are the same whether you're making the investments or not. If I could just turn to the next page and really diagnose essentially why it's broken is, if you look at the ELF, now the ELF, and I'm spend a lot of time going through the history of it, but the ELF was supposed to be a proxy for costs. It was supposed to be a high ELF for the oil that was easy to get out of the ground, and low for the expensive oil that was hard to get out of the ground. But if you do the mathematics and say, at the current system, if instead of using the ELF, I had a deduction for costs, how many costs would be in that deduction? In other words, what kind of costs would be required at a 15% tax rate to produce a $927 million tax bill? And the answer is about $5 billion. So what we see in this slide is, if we replace the ELF the current system with a deduction for actual costs to generate the same revenues, it would take about $5 billion, more than twice what we actually see today. So what's broken is the fact that the ELF was a very poor substitute or a very poor proxy for costs. And the main reason is the ELF bore no relation to price. At the kind of prices we saw in 1999, at $9 prices, the ELF would not even have covered all the costs that were spent. At prices in the $55 to $60 range that we have now, they create a proxy which is many times higher than the actual cost. So what happens is, of the current system, there's a deduction as if costs were being incurred, as if investment was being made, but it's not being made. We're receiving a tax that we would have if those investments were made, but we're not getting the investments. So what the economic limit factor did as a proxy is it wasn't accurate enough. It wasn't. It didn't deal. It doesn't deal with the price range that we see today. Excuse me. So now this example, I know we'll go through a couple of these in more detail. I try to fit in how this all works out, but I think you've seen two of the main features that are going to be in our, that are in the proposed production tax, but are not in the current system, and that is a credit for the for investments that are made, for investment in the North Slope, and a recognition that it costs money to get oil out of the ground, and therefore those costs should also affect the tax burden.
So, Mr. Dickinson, for once again, a big picture question:
yes,
the risk for the state would be high investment prices crash, you have to write it off, and yet you don't have your value then, which intellectually doesn't make a lot of sense because if the prices are low, there won't be the investment. But how much risk, I guess I should just wait. I'll say it's a question that I want answered in your presentation somehow. How much risk is the state exposed to by having big investment and followed by low prices, where we have to pay back the cost, but we don't have the money to do so? So as you get to it.
Right. No, Representative Samuels, I think that's a very good question, and it's one that we've wrestled with. And let me just answer a short version of it, because we are going to address it later on. I think you correctly identified the problem. The problem area would be investments are made in a high-cost arena, and then prices fall, because as you correctly say, in a low-price environment, there isn't additional money around for investment. I think we've seen the kind of money in the recent profit statements from our major investors here to know there is money for investment available now. One of the things that you'll see, and Roger Marsh will break this out a lot more specifically, is in a low-price environment, especially 4 or 5 years down the road, the production tax, we would only be collecting $100 or $200 million in production tax. And you're right, under the PPT, let's say we're going to collect $200 million, instead we only collect $100 million. My suggestion for you, particularly if you go back to some of the earlier slides, is when our production tax is only $200 million, there's a very large hole in this particular apple or this particular pie, and the fact that it's $100 million lower isn't that, there's simply going to have to be other measures taken at those low prices, whether we were in the PPT or not. The thing to contrast that with is when prices are high, we'll get, say, $1 billion more. That's the prediction, for example, for this year. So for every year of high prices, it may take 4 or 5 or 6 years of low prices, extremely low prices, to actually set the balance between those two. But you're right, the state's going to have to look at other ways of dealing with cash flows, the kinds of things that it has done before, let's say, the CBR, kind of proposals have been out there relating to other cash sources, and keeping an even keel when the revenues are more volatile. There's no question that this bill would make revenues more volatile, but I'll suggest to you they'll also be higher over time.
Okay, and I've got one other question, and I'll get to Representative McGuire.
Please.
Another question that I would like answered in the next 3 days, not necessarily right now, but the cost allocations is a problem. Is it addressed in the bill? Are you looking at some of it in regulations? What is allowed? What is not allowed? The trust between industry and the state, they're not going to trust us to have the regulator do it because they'll think that you're not going to allow certain real costs. And on the other hand, I don't want to pay for a building in Houston. So the cost allocation is going to be a huge portion of this as we go forward. And I haven't gotten to that part of the bill yet, reading through it, but as you go through it, I want some specific attention to cost allocation and how the auditing mechanisms will work. Representative McGuire.
Just on that point to the chair, I think it's a very real situation that the chairman poses, because we allow in this legislation for unused tax credits to be transferred. And so you can envision a scenario where, you know, prices start to dip. Folks may not be exploring actively, but they may have these unused tax credits out in circulation that are applied. And I guess the question is, I have not read through the bill in its current form, but I know there was discussion. I see that the unused tax credits are transferable, so I know that's still part of it. How many years are they transferable? I heard 5 years at one point. What's in the bill now?
Representative McGuire, through the chair, there is no limit on how long those transfers can be used. And let me focus in on that point. What we've tried to do is make those credits as trade at as close to their face value as possible. So if I'm a small explorer, I come in, I sink 3 dry holes in a row, I say, gosh, I'm done with Alaska, I'm out of here. What I will have done is generated a bunch of losses, a bunch of tax credits. That investor, as they approach Alaska, should know that it can sell that tax credit as close to cents on the dollar as they can do it. And as you're aware, this is a feature that we introduced in SB 185, and it's been out there for several years, and we have seen trading going on of these credits at over 90 cents on the dollar. The notion is the folks taking a risk who are likely to incur the losses, we want those to be able to trade at full value, and therefore we did not put a restriction on how long they could be used. There are other restrictions in there. We'll get into them in more detail when we go through the bill. Clearly, the problem that you've addressed is a real one. One of the important points to note is, though, is that none of these can be used to reduce the tax burden below zero. These are not refundable credits. They can never create a draw on the Treasury, a need for a refund. So, again, when you look at the kind of low price environment that Representative Samuels was talking about, and it's one that, you know, will occur again. We just don't know for when, and we don't know for how long. I think the important point to note is, even though taxpayers may be able to reduce their credits to zero, they won't go any far any below that. And when prices recover, then there'll be revenues flowing again.
Through the chair, just to follow up on that, did the department consider at all setting a cap? It's a great comfort that it doesn't go below zero, but did the department consider perhaps at 50%, for example? There are other incentive bills the legislature has dealt with in other industries, the raw fish tax, for example. It's 5 years, so there's a limit on the time period for the transferability, and then there's also a limit on the percentage. So the state knows it will always get 50% back of that raw fish tax.
Representative McGuire, through the chair, there is a limit on the traded credits. In other words, if the credits purchased, there is a limit of 20%. In other words, it can only be used to reduce the tax by 20%. However, if a taxpayer generates their own credits, makes a huge investment, and then prices fall, we did not restrict their ability to use those credits in the future. And again, if I can just follow up on something that Commissioner Menge said, there are lots of features in this bill in which you can look at current practices and you can look at other things. And as you look at this, this is the kind of thing that we need to get cleaned up and get a sense of what's going on. I think there's a lot of things like this that we had a lot of internal debates on, it's going to be debated in a much wider circle now.
Thank you. Representative Garrett had a question.
Mr. Chair, here's a question I have about, you said early on that tax policy often does have a major impact on investment. And I'm trying to get my arms around whether or not I should believe this one's going to have any major, major impact. Let me just share something with you. According to the Department of Revenue, at $20 barrel oil for next year, company profits would be somewhere in the $1 billion range, but at $60 barrel oil, it jumps about 600% to about $7 billion. Those are their best estimates. Under the current system, in the last 3 years, oil company profits have multiplied 500%, down to 500, 600%. They pay a 0% production tax, and investment has gone down. So 600% more money is available to them, and they know when they invest, they're likely going to pay 0% in production taxes. Under this proposal, we're going to give them an extra 20% of their costs back for new investments. And we're going to charge them a 15% tax, or 20% tax, or 25% tax, or whichever we go with. So on one hand, you have a 0% tax and 600% more money, which leads to less investment. Why should I believe that giving them 20% more money and increasing their taxes is going to lead to substantially more investment than the current system, where there's been much more free cash flow in the last 3 or 4 years?
Representative Garrow, through the chair, I'm not sure I understand the hypothetical. The current tax rate on the North Slope is, as I said, about between 7 and 8% effective rate. Now, most new fields, investment in a new field, you are correct. There are two fields that have come on in the last several years, North Star and Alpine. They're paying, again, tax rates close to 10%. Other smaller fields are paying tax rates, as you say, essentially zero or there. So I'm not sure I understood that. I mean, folks making investments now, particularly in anything other than the smallest fields, will expect to pay a tax. If I can opine, I mean, one of the reasons why investments were not being made in Alaska and are being made in other places in the world is because other places in the world reward those investments differently. So if you're in a situation where a dollar earned in a country, you can reinvest in that country for 100 cents on the dollar, or you can export it for 60 cents on the dollar, you're going to make the investment there. What's interesting is if you can take your profits generated in Alaska, bring it to that other country, invest it, and also get support from it, in other words, invest, import 60 cents in it, and essentially invest with a dollar's worth of investment, I think you'll find that's where investment flows. So part of the reason, and again, I'm not going to claim that people sit here and every decision is driven by tax rates. It simply isn't. But part of the reason that investment has flowed to places that recognize investment is because you could make bigger investments, or your investments have more bang for the buck. So I think the answer, is the reason we haven't seen the investment in Alaska, among the reasons we haven't seen the investment in Alaska, is because we don't reward investment through our tax system.
3 days. Do you have a follow-up? I don't want to stifle the debate, but if we get into the details before we have the presentation. Right.
Thank you. I guess the point I was trying to make is most of the fields pay currently a 0% tax. Most have some pay upwards of a 7 or 10% tax. We're proposing to increase that tax under this new system. In the last few years, a lot more cash flow has been made free to companies just because of the product of oil prices going up so high. And you're proposing to give them a 20% tax credit, give them 20% extra money. I mean, just tell me that giving them a 20% benefit is going to lead to so much more investment than the sort of 600% benefit that oil prices have given them that has led to a decline in investment.
Representative Garrow, through the chair. Again, there are two pieces to this, and the fact that both 20% I think is going to get confusing in the dialogue. But a 20% tax rate means for every dollar generated and not reinvested in the state, we get 20 cents on it. Feds will pick up 30 and kind of look what that looks like. Government take would approach in the 60% range. The company would take home 40%, 40 cents on that on any dollar. We are moving that rate up. So once the value of the tax base is calculated, we are now taking a larger piece of it. But what we're saying is in this bill is we give you the opportunity to lower your tax base because we'll now recognize the investments that you make to create more product, have more production. So, I mean, clearly, one question to say is, gosh, if people thought that an investment would still bring them returns at $60 a barrel, why wouldn't every sort of possible hole in the ground be drilled that could be drilled? And the answer is no. We can never create the same incentives that the current price structure does now. The tax system simply wouldn't be able to do that. What we're trying to do is a little more focused, which is to say, as folks are making investment decisions, we want to make investment in Alaska a better proposition, and we want to, especially if you're generating profits in Alaska, we want to make exporting those dollars and investing them elsewhere a little less favorable proposition to you. And at the margin, we're hoping that's going to change the behavior that you've talked about.
Good. Please continue.
Thank you.
I beg your pardon, Representative Crawford. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was listening to your explanation about the credits a while ago, and you used an example that the small company drilled three dry holes, so they built up losses. If I understand this correctly, the credits don't come from just losses. I thought that they got the credits whether it's a dry hole or a find. Am I wrong, or what did I miss?
Representative Crawford, through the chair. No, you're exactly right. I was trying to use an example of someone who would, why anyone could ever take it on their mind to leave our fine state of Alaska. But, I mean, what I was trying to do is create a sort of a worst-case situation from a company. Comes up here, spends a bunch of money, gets zero return on their investment. What we want to say to that company before they, when they make the decision of what their downside is, we're saying, the state will, in fact, pick up part of that loss indirectly through the tax credits. Now, you're absolutely right that the tax credits and the operating losses, both those pieces will apply. We never ask the question, was it successful, was it a dry hole, or wasn't it? I think one of the things that we've looked at, and this has been confirmed, and the economists may speak about it more tomorrow, is supporting exploration. Note, so that folks know that dry hole costs will not be as big as they might be if that wasn't supported, is one of the most best ways that you can try to incentivize or grow future production. Once a company has drilled and found oil, and chances are it's going to go ahead and make those developments. What we're trying to do is step back in the beginning of the process, and we're saying, we're going to look at the exploration. That's why, for example, SB 185 looked only at exploration. Said, let's go in at the exploration level and let's create a credit there. Because if you know that, like I say, the dry hole is the downside, and what we're saying is that the downside, we're going to make the downside a little bit less worse. You're welcome. Mr. Chairman, if I can go on to the next slide, which is a replay, but it's basically looking at, again, Alaska oil production and the decline there. The second problem that I want to identify is the fact that the economic limit factor used production as one of the things in the equation. I'm not going to flash the economic limit factor equation up here and ask you all to go through it, but trust me that it used the volume, both the average production from wells as well as the average volume of the field in which the well was located to calculate the tax rate. So one of the problems that we see, and the next slide will illustrate it, is what happens as volume falls. As folks are very aware, the ELF is an exponential formula. You take a number, you multiply it times itself 1.5 times. But the net effect of having an exponent in there is that as volume falls, the ELF fell much more quickly. And I think this slide gives you a clear indication. What you can see is production at Kuparuk has been declining roughly at 7% a year. But as Kuparuk's volume fell, its ELF fell much more dramatically. So if we go back to the high point of Kuparuk production in about 1993, we look over on the left-hand side of the graph, it was producing a third of a million barrels a day, 300,000 barrels a day. and the ELF was about 0.8. At a 15% tax rate, that would mean an effective rate of about 12% of every barrel was being taxed. As the production declined from 300,000 barrels a day down to 200,000 barrels a day, down to where you can see that the ELF fell from about 0.8 to about 0.5. So even though you had about a fall of about one-third, the ELF more than halved. And then if you look at the change from about 2000 to 2005, where production fell from about 200,000 barrels a day down to about 90,000 barrels a day, the ELF essentially disappeared. It simply went off the map. I don't know what it is this year. It's like 0.00 something. The point is, as the volumes fall, the ELF fell much more dramatically. Now, on a production tax that was based on every volume that you produced, as your volume fell, even without the ELF, we would have had falling production tax revenues. But what's happened is, for fields that hit this point, this rate of decline, where they trigger this dramatic change in the ELF, the rate of decline in revenues is much, much, much quicker than it is in the decline in production. So the problem is, in this production tax, again, is that what happens is, as we have declining volumes, as we have maturing fields, the tax was falling not only as a consequence of production falling, but the ELF was making the tax go essentially to zero. If we look at the two fields that I talked about a moment ago that came on in the last 5 years, Alpine and North Star, you will see, and I think folks may have seen this chart before, called it the bombs bursting in air chart. Those have ELFs about 0.8, 0.9. As you look at their volumes, when their volumes fall by about 50%, those ELFs go over a space of 5 or 6 years from this current level of above 0.9 down to zero. The sensitivity to volumes is overstated. So that's the second major problem with the ELF. It was meant to be a proxy for costs, and it tied that to volumes, but the sensitivity to volumes was overstated, just as the sensitivity to price was understated. The last slide here makes that general point, that in the future, we see, based on work on volumes that we see coming out today, this does not include new fields, and again, this is from the Department of Revenues or Revenue Sources book. As we see production falling, if you do it in the earlier graph, or is holding basically steady, the ELF will continue to decline. As the volumes, as per well productivity falls, the ELF continues to decline. As the percent of a new smaller fields comes on, the overall ELF for the North Slope declines. So the question is, should we have a tax system that automatically falls, that has a smaller tax on each barrel that is remaining to be produced, or, as we're proposing here, we tax the profitability on each barrel, and we don't tie the fact that the overall production is falling, don't use that to drive down the taxability on each barrel. So, Mr. Chairman, those are descriptions of some of the major problems in the current economic limit factor, and I think, Chris, you have a question there.
Chairman Ramos.
Thank you. Excellent presentation, Mr. Dickinson. I want to go out of the box with you for a second and ask, because I see on this agenda you're going to be back with us on day three. So I'm going to ask you for an addendum to this presentation, which is entitled Current Production Tax and Why It Is a Problem. Money, we are going to generate a surplus, some amount this year. The royalty oil that flows into the permanent fund, other than the dividends, that money is invested around the world, the lower 48, not generally in Alaska. Money that goes for government services doesn't generally help the Alaskan economy. So what I'd like for you to address for us on day three, if you and your folks can, is along with this incentive for exploration comes the economic multiplier that's going to be created by all this additional exploration And I'd like to see what that will do for employment opportunities, for revenue and dollars that go into our economy, because I found that, although I think you gave a great presentation, I found that why it is a problem is also why we have had retarded growth in the Alaskan economy over this, as the elf broke and as production broke down. We also have not had the blossoming economy that we should have had in this industry in oil field service related growth. And so I don't want to pose a question now because our time is so limited on our time, but if you can put together just a few minutes with different scenarios of exploration at these different rates that have been thrown out here, $1 billion, $2 billion, $3 billion, what that would mean when we apply some kind of an economic multiplier, I'd be appreciative to see how broken is that part of the system by omission. That's okay.
Representative Van Lat, certainly. I mean, I think you've made the point, and I think it's very true that when we talk about investment yielding more barrels, that's only one of the effects, and clearly any work going on the North Slope or around the state has a multiplier effect, and we can see if we can put some of those numbers together for you.
Any other questions? Are you through, Dan?
I am, sir.
Any other questions for Mr. Dickinson? Okay, thank you very much. You're going to be here for the next hour, Dan? So you're going to be here for the next presentation? Okay.
Thank you. Again, for the record, I'm Robin Wilson, Tax Division Director. And what I'd like to talk about today is just, again, an overview of the bill before you to give you a context for the detailed analysis that will happen tomorrow and Friday. And as Dan said, problems with the current production tax is that it gives no incentive in the tax system to reinvest in Alaska. It has a low take internationally at high prices and a high take at low prices. Commonly, that can be referred to as a regressive tax. And the maturing of the North Slope leads to decline in tax revenue. And so I'd like you to sort of...
Mr. Chairman, I've heard this a couple times today. Forgive me for interrupting, Mr. Wilson, but to say there's no incentive in the tax system to reinvest in Alaska currently, I don't think that's a correct statement. The ELF was designed to try to generate reinvestment here. The question is whether it's working or not. That's another issue. But I think that you can make the case, and I'm sure, I know $1 billion is not what it used to be, but I think the producers are investing substantial money. So. I take some caution there. I am concerned about what I would consider the de facto tax credit that Representative Garber was referring to. I think there's some merit to what he says. But on the other hand, he said there's no incentive in the ELF. That's the way it has been designed. I'm not sure. I'm not comfortable with that flat statement. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Roker, through the chair, if I might, I think it's a fair point, and maybe we should say that there's no effective incentive. But I think that the point we're really narrowing in on is, you know, investment can be its own reward, and clearly that's why most investments are made. And what we're really trying to narrow down is that there's not a specific incentive tied to the amount of the investment.
I think you have to wait till Monday to have the producers try to rebut your statement. You
know. Fair point.
Okay, so as I'm talking about the various points of the bill, I'd like you to sort of keep four ideas in mind. You know, the relative encouragement of investment, competitive rates internationally, encouragement of small companies, to come up to Alaska and invest. And the efforts that have been made on streamlining the tax process. Now I would say that there's five real basic elements of the bill before you. The first is the tax base. That is what is taxed. And as Dan mentioned earlier, the key difference between the current tax system and the proposed tax system is that the current tax system is based on gross, and the proposed tax system would be based on a net profit. And I'll go through each of these individually. The rate, again, as we've said, will be 20% as proposed. The third part of this are the incentive credits, and I would suggest that those are an expanded system of credits. There is a base allowance, and that is the $73 million that you may have seen or heard about. That is, and what I will try to do is sort of bring this back in people's reference to their own tax return, perhaps. And I guess I would see the base allowance as being sort of akin to the standard deduction. And then finally, there is a transition provision that recognizes recent investments in oil exploration and production.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Capshaw.
And I know you're not encouraging people to ask questions right now, but while we're on this, could you change your slide? Is it the next slide that you're referring to right now?
No, it's this one.
Okay. You mentioned the $37 million base allowance.
73.
I'm sorry, 73. This is going on finance. $73 million base allowance. Do we have any other industries in Alaska that have a base allowance akin to this?
Through the chair.
Of course, it wouldn't be that size, but do we allow a tax credit of that magnitude in any other, or I mean, not necessarily that amount, but of that type?
Representative Capster, through the chair, off the top of my head, the only thing I can think of that's somewhat similar is the mining license tax, which is also based on a net profitability. And again, there's an extended period of time in which there is no tax paid as a consequence of startup. I would have to, since I'm not director anymore, I don't know the details, but I would have to look that up. We can get back to you on that.
Thank you.
Representative Katula.
Yeah. So this is going to be a $73 million allowance on net or on gross? I mean, is it on just the pure profit that we're going to allow this?
Yes.
Through the chair, Representative Katula, it would be on net, and I will definitely go through that a little further. I just kind of wanted to set the framework of the five pieces that we'll be talking about. And also just a point of clarification, when we talk about the base allowance, that is in effect a deduction, that is as opposed to the incentive credits. And again, sort of referring back to people's own personal returns, I guess I would liken a deduction as something like the charitable contribution deduction or the standard deduction, whereas credits we're talking about are more akin to, say, the child care credit and some of those, dollar for dollar things. So I would just make that distinction at this point. Okay, and just a word, perhaps not everyone is, as an accountant, and the gross versus net can be confusing. So on this next slide, what I am just basically showing is that the bottom line may be exactly the same whether you're on a gross system or a net system. But on the left, I've shown the current tax structure, which is based on gross, which is just, and I've made up numbers here, value at the wellhead of 50 times the tax rate of 15 gives a tax before application of the ELF of $7.50. It ignores for a moment the ELF. And on the right, under the proposed tax plan, value at the wellhead, which is essentially unchanged, less operating expenses, lease operating expenses, and again, I'm just making up numbers here just to show the net versus gross, gives a net taxable of $3,750 times the tax rate, gives the tax before credits of exactly the same. It makes sense that when you tax net, your tax rate will be higher. So that's just kind of a thing to keep in mind. And so the lease operating expenses, again, referring back to a personal return or perhaps a business return, business expenses, you know, such as on your personal return, perhaps travel, if you have a small business, advertising, things like that. Under the PPT, you know, you're talking about lease operating expenses. But that's what we're talking about when we're talking about writing off expenses to get to a net number. And I'll come back again in a couple of slides on this as well. The tax base, again, starts with gross value at point of production. Now, as you will see tomorrow and the next day, we've made some efforts to streamline that, to simplify it a little bit, but it's essentially the same as under the current system. Lease expenditures, again, operating costs, and the next thing is capital expenditures. The difference between expenses, operating costs, and capital expenditures is that capital expenditures are expected to generate income over a number of years, something more than just 1 year. That's sort of an accounting definition of the two terms. But in a business, normally people expect to invest in a machine, in a fishing boat, or whatever it is, and then depreciate that asset over some given period of time. And that recognizes that that asset is generating income over its life. What has been presented in this bill is the same idea, but we don't look at depreciation. The plan allows for basically immediate write-off of capital expenditures. So just as normal lease operating expenses are deductible in the year that they're incurred, by the same token, then machinery, things that are normally capitalized that will have a life of a number of years, are immediately written off. So that's an important point to keep in mind for later in the presentation. There will also be an allowance for overhead, and the exact formula of that has not been fleshed out. There's provision for the department to write regulations, but there is a recognition that a certain amount of overhead is necessary for the lease work to function. The lease expenditures must be direct costs, and they must be ordinary and necessary, which is a pretty common, particularly in the Internal Revenue Code, that's a requirement for writing off general business expenses. It's that they must be ordinary and necessary. I will refer you just, again, we will have a section-by-section analysis of the bill, but at this point, I guess I would just direct you that the deductible expenses are in Section 21. The section starts on page 11, and then it talks about direct and ordinary and necessary on page 12. So I would just, you know, you can jot that down, and again, we will come back to that. The department will write regulations determining what is direct and giving some guidance on ordinary and necessary. But the bill specifies that substantial weight is to be given to industry practice and also with reference to standards adopted by Department of Natural Resources. And there
is... As far as the cost allocation, you're talking about the allowances for the overhead. Completely in the regulatory environment, then determined. And do you perceive that right now? A lot of the complaints from both the industry and the administrations is the conflict, the constant conflict between the two on valuations
do you foresee a problem coming up with valuations now on the other side, on the cost side of things, on the allowance for overhead? Like I stated here a little while ago, is industry is going to be mistrustful that we're not going to allow certain expenses that they think are very real. I'm not going to want to pay for the building in London and Houston.
Well,
and in the regulation, do you foresee the conflict not going away because it's not in the statute?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is an area where there is some streamlining, as I would see it, because we will look at, there's an option to treat as lease expenditures the costs that are paid by a producer that are billed to the working interest owner. So there's some recognition of, you know, already sort of industry practices, already practices established by agreement, where there is joint interest held in there. There may be disagreements about allocation of overhead. But again, you know, we have been given sort of marching orders, and so I would hope that would minimize the conflict.
And the time frame on those regulations, have you started down this road, or just know you're going to have to do it eventually? What's the timeline on having those regulations written and available for review?
We have not started down on this road just yet. We recognize that it will need to be done. It may be needing to be done on an expedited basis, on an emergency basis. That hasn't been resolved yet. Okay.
Thank you. Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Wilson, has the net profits formula in the Alaska lease, oil and gas leases, ever been litigated on any of these items?
To the Chair, Representative Roper, if I might ask Mr. Dickinson to address that.
Representative Roper, through the Chair, I don't believe it's gotten to litigation. It certainly has been, there has been differences, but I may turn to Gary Rogers, who's in the audience. I don't believe that the overhead was one of those, because I believe that is specified in the net profit share regulations as they exist. And so that isn't necessarily a question, an open question. Generally, the open questions are the things that aren't specified.
Are you not adopting the USCM in the main, though? The tax code?
Representative Roper, through the Chair, we will. For capitalized expenses, in other words, the rules that say when you self-construct an asset, how much of your overhead can go into that, or has to go into that, as the service would put it, we will be adopting the federal code for that, the IRC. You're absolutely correct. I think the issue we're looking at is, for example, when the operator, for example, at Prudhoe Bay, uses an engineer in Anchorage to do work on the North Slope, when they bill that to the other working interest owners, to the ConocoPhillips and to Exxon and to Chevron, there'll be an overhead attached to that, which will cover the building in Anchorage, will cover the costs above and beyond just that individual salary. So when we say we're going to look at industry practice, that's really what we want to look at, is in a situation like Prudhoe Bay, where there are lease expenses, how does the operator charge overhead to the other lessees?
Be careful on Jeffrey.
As of Gettner.
Thank you. As we go down the road on this analysis, are you at some time going to have an analysis of these expenditures and calculations for an independent versus the producers?
Representative Goodman, through the Chair, the expenses are going to be generally, for a lease, you're generally going to have several different working owners, and they will come, the operator spends the dollars, and then the working interest owners look over their shoulder and try to figure out if they did that appropriately or correctly. When you have an independent or even a wholly owned operation, as for example, Bailey Point is 100% owned by BP or Northstar, there's no one looking over their shoulder, that's when it's going to get a little bit harder, and that's where we're just going to have to look at industry practice and set out rules that embody industry practice and try to make sure that we're coming as close to a reasonable number as possible. I mean, one of the reasons, Representative Samuels, one of the reasons why we, to answer an earlier question, we didn't try to embody a rule in here is we thought having regulations with a direction to look at industry practice would probably keep us more in line than trying to hardwire a number.
Follow up? Or, no? Before I get to Representative Seaton's question, another, just, I don't know if it's a problem or not, there was a bill in the legislature last year or the year before on a decoupling because the federal government did something that, that we did not like. I can't remember exactly what the issue was, but do you foresee a problem here, or is it possible that the feds now can go and do something? And I realize out of the total billion or billion two, at, I think it's $60 oil that the presentation by Van Mears was made, was that the feds were actually going to pay a quarter to a third of the money in their lost revenue on the income taxes. If they change their rules after, and more in the context of if we go long term with this, if they change their rules, is there some worry that now we're stuck with a system that instead of, you know, us having a conflict with the industry and we move down the road together with them, now the feds come in and do something to the two of us that changes the economics of the project or the economics of the state? Is there a concern of that, and has that been addressed in the bill at all? And once again, I don't need an answer to the question, but sometime in the next 3 days, perhaps address the fear that the feds come in and change the rules of the game and do to us what industry fears that we do to them. So, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, just following up on this establishing it by regulation, I'm just curious. You know, we're looking at establishing the oil statute and then coupling that possibly with a future vote into gas. Now, is that going to couple in the regulations, or are we essentially setting up regulations that basically determine some tax policy that could be changed at a future date that are not going to be tied in here? I mean, I just see future conflict and future litigation possibilities if we're talking about trying to couple the statutes into the long-term gas, but then we're decoupling regulations that could be changed. Is that a, could that be a future problem?
Representative Seaton, through the chair. Clearly, in the context of the Stranded Gas Act, discussions about fiscal stability focus very much on regulations because that's viewed as something that the department really can do, even though we take advice and listen to the public. Essentially, the decision-making process rests with the department. So within the Stranded Gas Act, that's clearly a focus of those fiscal stability discussions. Moving over to this bill, what we're trying to do here is create enough flexibility. If I can actually, the cost areas here are much more specific than they are in the current statute. I think, you know, as I've observed with several people, the current statute spends 12 words talking about what costs are. And yet, that's something that we've written hundreds of pages of regulations interpreting what those 12 words do. It just talks about the actual cost of the transportation of the oil or gas. And you know, you look at our regulation book, and it's huge. So we've tried to be more specific here than when we were in the past, but we still tried to maintain the flexibility. And clearly, what's contemplated in the Stranded Gas Act, and again, I can only tell you sort of a window into that, is a discussion about regulations and the effects that they may or may not have on someone signing a Stranded Gas Act contract.
I'd like to get an answer back later then, but I would like it addressed. So, you know, if we are looking at this, I mean, this is a standalone bill, but the intent is to have a future vote to tie this into a stranded gas bill. But what I want to know is, will the regulations that are establishing these costs, is the intention to tie those into the stranded gas as well, or is this a point at which we could then have litigation because a future time we're going to change the regulations, changing what are allowable costs, and therefore it wasn't tied together?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, excuse me, you're right, I didn't quite answer that question the first time. I think what we what we contemplate is that where the statute sets up the option for regulations, essentially in the Shale and Gas Act, we might essentially come up with that. So for example, if it says reuse overhead, we might go in the Shale and Gas Act and say, here's how we'll do overhead. Under the schedule it's contemplated, I think the hope is that the Shale and Gas Act will be completed before the regulatory process would be on the bill. So we might have a situation in which someone in the Shale and Gas Act, a signatory to that, had one set of interpretations, essentially, whereas someone not signing it would have something different. They'd be under the same, statutory authority, but the interpretation might be slightly different, depending on what was left to the regulatory.
Mr. Roper.
Mr. Chairman, following up on what you requested of the department earlier about coming back to committee, if there were a change in federal law, the issue of a federal windfall profit tax and the impact, I wish you could take a speak to that.
When you come back to this, I mean, how much exposure do both, I think in the context of my question would be, how much exposure would both the state and industry collectively have to what the feds do to us as we move down the road? To we agree on this tax rate, or and then you move into gas, and then the feds change the rules on the road with the windfall profits tax that affects our take or industry's take, and all of a sudden the economics are blown, but the contract is signed. What does that do to us?
Representative Roper, through the chair, if I might perhaps clarify something, and then we'll talk about the question a little bit more, perhaps. When we talk about what happens if the feds change this or that, that is critical in the income tax area because we adopt the Internal Revenue Code. But in the production tax, what the plan is, it really is a standalone bill that does not piggyback off the Internal Revenue Code except specific areas. For example, if the feds deem that something should be capitalized, then we consider it to be capitalized. So you could certainly have a situation in the future where the feds say, oh, well, we want to generate activity. We don't want to capitalize this or that. Yes, that's certainly possible. But I guess I would just like to emphasize that we're not adopting the code generally for this. So things like if there was a windfall profits tax, that would sort of be NA for this because it's a tax based on net income. And the other place, I guess I just referenced the Internal Revenue Code was simply we've put in the language in here that says ordinary and necessary. And so I was just encouraging people to kind of think back, you know, this is kind of the way the feds do it, but we're not piggybacking off the federal system. So does that help? Does that help answer the question?
So you're not adopting it by reference in total, right?
No, absolutely not.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The last point I'd like to make, and it's just really brief on this slide, is that any lease expenses where the producer is receiving a reimbursement, say from another taxpayer, another producer, or from the government for some reason, those reimbursements would be taken off of the expense amount. So that's just a small item there. The next slide sort of lists expenses that are not deductible. And the first one, you may say, well, what about depreciation? I get it on my tax return. Well, again, I would remind you what I said a moment ago, and that is, you know, the asset will give a productive life of a certain amount of time, but for this bill, rather than depreciating it, we are saying the producer gets an immediate write-off. So because you've written off the entire asset in year one, there is no depreciation expense then in year two, three, four, et cetera. So that's why depreciation is specifically not deductible in this plan. The second item is royalty payments. The reason that it's not, royalty payments are not a deduction is because they never enter the calculation in the first place. Similarly, on your own personal tax return, things that are just plain tax exempt, they don't even show up on page one of your tax return. So the reason that they're not deductible is because they weren't in the pot in the first place. So that just clarifies that. Taxes based on net income, interest, those are general expenses that are not tied to leases, I think is the best way to look at it. And, you know, Dan can jump in here if he has more clarification, but I sort of view these as being general sort of administrative expenses. Other costs down there at the bottom would include, say, costs of arbitration, donations, costs of organizing partnerships, costs of organizing joint ventures, or any other business entity organization. And again, these are general type administration expenses that are not tied to certain leases. And I would refer you then in the bill, again, these are included in section 21, which starts on page 11, and the non-deductible list is at page 13. And we will, again, be going section by section, but I just thought I would give you that reference at this point.
Mr. Chair, if I might make one observation about the arbitrations. Generally, any conflict, any court case arbitration against the state, those costs are not credible, so we're sort of not going to be funding the opposition, if you will, nor are ones among them, among interest owners, as they argue about who owns what. On the other hand, if it was a case, an injury case or something like that, those kind of costs would be allowed. So if it's the kind of costs you need to run a business, those are allowed. If there are conflicts with us or their partners, we're not interested in picking up a piece of that.
Moving on then to the next slide. This is kind of circling back to the gross value. And I kind of wanted to give people an idea of how it is currently to come up with value. And many times, the oil is sold on the West Coast for a certain sales price. And what we do is sort of back up to what is the value at the wellhead. And in order to get there, we back out the transportation expenses, which would include the marine transportation and the TAPS pipeline transportation. And in this bill, what part of the goal here is to simplify this process because marine transportation expenses and so on particularly have been the subject of a lot of audit activity and take a lot of time to deal with. And so we did try to simplify that a little bit. And so under the PPT, the producer can elect to use royalty value. And that would be for the settlement agreements or other royalty values accepted by DNR. Also, the federal royalty value, if that's applicable. And the other option is to use a formula that we would write to regulation that estimates the value at a specific location, such as the point of delivery into a common carrier pipeline.
Okay, and question I would assume that a lot of people here are thinking is TSM 2009 as the state starts to look at, I mean, the slide before then, I mean, obviously the big piece is the middle piece there, the pipeline piece. So what are we writing in here that the trust on the tariff that is paid to the pipeline probably isn't as high as level as it quite possibly should be in this room or in this building. So what does the choice here, the royalty value, which would incorporate if a new methodology is adopted, what is choice two? How do those two play off against each other as we go down the road of looking at what that tariff on that pipeline should be?
Representative Samuels, I think you've honed in on a future area of a lot of discussion. When TSM expires, there's going to be an alternative, and when the what we contemplate in these regulations is going to publicly available values for calculating a netback, particularly for small folks who aren't doing their own, for example, their own tankering. So I at least as we had thought about this, I don't think we ever contemplated anything other than using a published tariff, assuming it would be a publicly regulated pipeline.
So whatever the
however that works itself out, for portion of the tax, if the rate goes up, goes down, whatever, whatever the regulatory environment or FERC, RCR, however that gets determined, that's the number that you will use for the tax calculation, and that's a separate fight.
Representative Samuels, that's really the contemplation. I mean, the actual, you know, the current standard, which you are not changing, talks about actual cost. So I suppose that if the department believed that what was ultimately determined was not actual cost, they could argue it was not deductible. I think in general what we've contemplated is we have enough arguments in our hands about other things. We'll let those fights go on in the proper forums, and when an answer emerges, that's what's properly deductible.
Pipeline methodology part of it, the tariff. Gotcha. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I just have a small request. Mr. Dickinson, could you lean back a little bit from your microphone, please, because some of it's kind of breaking up and I'm not catching certain keywords. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
And I just also would note on the formula, the bill specifies that the department may use other factors such as public price, published prices, quality differentials, applicable transportation costs, and inflation adjustments. So it's sort of, again, giving us guidance when we write the regulations. This has been repeated before. You will hear some of the same things several times this week, hopefully from different perspectives. But the basic tax rate is 20%, and that tax rate, setting the tax rate, is found in Section 5 on page 3 of your bill. Moving on then to credits. The bill sets out a plan of offering 20% of qualified capital expenditures, a credit of 20%, and that may be taken on exploration costs and capital costs incurred on the lease. And as has been mentioned before, the credits are transferable. The incentive credits are found in Section 10, which starts on page 4 of your bill. Exploration costs will include such things as geological and geophysical costs. And in summary, the credits, in summarizing the credits now, the producer that generated the credits can take the credits on their own tax return, or they can turn them into credit certificates and then sell those certificates. There's a mechanism in the bill for the Department of Revenue to issue the credit certificates upon being reasonably satisfied that the producer is qualifies for the credit. I would note, however, that the credits are later subject to audit. I will also note capital costs include intangible drilling costs, which are under the federal code now. Much of them are written off in the first year, that is 70%. But under the PPT, what we've said is you've got a credit on capital costs, and that includes any IDCs. I would note again on the transferability of the credits, the purchaser can only use the credits to reduce the purchaser's tax by 20%. So there is that limit on the credits.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Rutherford.
Yeah, in reviewing the transmittal letter here and the bill, it indicates that there'd also be a 20% credit for annual losses, but it can't be reduced to zero. So that seems to me as if we're having is it a 2020 bill, or is it 2020 or 20? You have to make the choice. You choose annually because it's whether you have a profit or a loss. Is that correct? Or do you have 20% of what you expend, and then you have 20% of your loss? So that's 40%. So can you help me out?
Through the chair, Representative Roseberg, let me move on to the next slide because
okay,
I specifically.
Oh, before you get to our
okay,
next
I will
slide,
address losses
your question.
In just a moment.
Did you have a question on this particular slide? Or?
I think it's the same question as Representative Rupert, where we're really giving a 40% credit, not just a 20% credit.
Okay.
So I'll wait and see if there's anything
else. Thank you.
Okay. Then moving on to the next slide. How are losses handled? And again, I want to be specific because I can throw out terms like NOL and not everybody's familiar with those terms. But how are losses handled? So if we look at a gross value, and again, I'm just making up numbers here, but if we have a gross value of 50 and we write off lease operating expenses of 1250 and we give a deduction for the capital expenditures, that is, write off the equipment that was purchased, that leaves at this point a net loss, which commonly is referred to as an NOL, net operating loss, of $2,250. Net operating losses, that's before any credit. Okay, right now you've gotten to sort of a negative place. You don't have any tax against which to apply the credit. So you have a loss, and what the bill provides for is that the loss can be converted into a credit, and we apply a 20% of that amount to just get it on a dollar for dollar. So, do you have a question at this point?
Yeah, what if I broke you?
Through the chair.
I think sometimes.
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Roper, if you broke even, if you, okay, moving back, I'm moving back in the slide, if that bottom line was zero,
right,
there would be no tax. You would not utilize any credit at that point.
Could I get a qualified investment credit of 20% on my investment? So I get 20%.
Well, you will get it on the books, but you will have to carry it forward. You can't use it in this year because in your example of breaking even, you have no tax to apply it to, so it would be carried forward.
Unfortunately, I know a lot about this last carry forward.
Representative Guerra.
It seems to, I'm worried that there's some double counting going on, and I think the root of it is in most tax credit schemes, we give you a tax credit for your exploration costs, but then when you find the oil, we then don't give you more credit for developing it. As Mr. Dickinson said, once you find the oil, you're likely going to develop at that point. You've struck gold. But the tax credit, the way it's written here, gives you a tax credit for exploration. And then you also get your 20% credit for building your facility. So there's 20% there, and then if you're a profitable company, when you pay your 20% tax on the other side, you're deducting your costs. And so you're deducting 20% of your costs on the tax side and getting a 20% credit on the credit side. For those companies that are making a profit and qualify under both systems, aren't they getting a 40% credit, or what am I missing?
Through the chair, yes, you are correct in that if there is a piece of equipment on the lease, you will be able to write off the cost of the equipment in year one as a deduction, and that will also qualify for a tax credit of 20%. You are absolutely right. Now, that is specifically, again, it was part of the thinking of the entire bill, sort of the holistic view is to maximize incentive for investment and getting those dollars in. So that is clearly a part of the bill, that something like equipment or the exploration costs are written off and they're available for credit.
So this really benefits the bigger companies that are making a profit, so they get it on both ends. And I guess I'm asking as a matter of policy, I mean, isn't that why we normally only grant the credit for exploration costs to help you find the oil, but normally don't give you incentives once you found the oil to build the infrastructure? Yeah, as a matter of policy, why does it make sense? Maybe you're not the right people to ask, Dan, but why, as a matter of policy, should we want to also give a credit after you've struck gold?
Great.
Go ahead.
Actually, let me answer your first question first, if I might. The notion that it a bigger company or a smaller company, I don't think enters into that. In other words, if you have a net, if you have an expense, you get 20%. If that expense has brought you below zero, so you have a net operating loss, you can convert it into a credit so that it will have some eventual effect on your tax. But that's going to be the same whether you're large or you're small. So maybe I didn't understand the notion that this would help big companies but would not help small companies. You're going to have the same, the availability of the credit, of the deduction is the same whether you're large or small. Equally so of the credit.
I don't want to quibble. Go ahead.
Okay.
I
said that wrong. On the second question, I represent Gary through the chair. I think, you know, you're quite right that the state certainly looked at incentivizing credits for expiration and expiration only. One of the reasons that this larger policy call was made was looking at the kinds of investments that were occurring and whether, in fact, a focus on merely exploration versus exploiting resources that we know that they're there in place, but for whatever reason appear to be more challenged. For example, heavy oil, we've all heard a lot about it. Folks can lay out for you pretty clearly where heavy oil is, but the question is, should we be creating a system where you go out and you incentivize finding light oil more than just taking a known reserve of heavy oil and monetizing it? So as we looked at the resources in the North Slope, we focused on exploration is important, absolutely, but so too is taking some of the more challenged pools of oil where we know exactly where they are. Some of them are even producing at very low rates now and trying to incent the technology and the investment to get those up and running at a higher productivity level.
Any other questions? Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to get bogged down in this, but I do have a concern about the heavy oil and frontier exploration and even having a potentiality and discussion about a two-tiered system. Plus, and that relates back to any kind of future three-step gas line deal, whether we would want to adopt by reference something that would be much more volatile, and whether they should even be adopted or looked at as separate legislation. You know, if the policy call was there. So that's something that troubles me about whether, number one, should we have the policy further incentive for those types of investment, and secondly, whether they should be in a statutory scheme that will be adopted contractually. Let's not get bogged down with that.
Actually, if I could just clarify that, I mean, what we're trying to do is not create a multi-tiered system in that we're trying to make all, you know, whether you go for frontier exploration or development of known or resource, you would get the same bang for the investment buck.
Well, I'm not sure that's working, but so I think it's something we can talk about.
Okay. Thank you. Any
And if I could just make one more mention on the small producer versus large, I see the ability to transfer credits specifically on that point. You know, whereas the large producer with a lot of taxable income, you know, may be able to take advantage of both the deduction and the credit immediately. Similarly, I see where a small producer perhaps, you know, generating a zero bottom line, then you've got a tax credit that can be sold. So I kind of see that as being not necessarily setting up a two-tier system, but in fact establishing some equal opportunity there. And lastly, on the net operating loss, I would just direct your attention to page 5 of the bill, and that is section 12. Okay, and then now we move on to the base allowance, which, you know, there were a question or two before. $73 million, where did that come from? That came from, and again, the economists will go into much more detail on this tomorrow, but it was, in effect, allowing $200,000 a day net profit to be generated without being taxed. So it's basically a standard deduction for the producers. And as was noted, it cannot generate a net operating loss. So if you start with your gross value, you subtract off your lease expenses, and you get to zero, you break even, then this base allowance doesn't even come into play. It does not create a loss to be carried forward in the future or anything else. It's just, it's taken in monthly chunks, but it is a yearly amount. And that is in section 21, which starts on page 11. It is per NJ at page 16 specifically. And then there's a few minor provisions. Again, Dan will be walking through all the individual sections for you. But I just would note, under the current system, we have a monthly return filing. Under the proposed system, we would also have a monthly return filing. What is different is that this bill envisions sort of a 90% safe harbor amount month by month, similar to income taxes, that they're sort of a safe harbor when you make estimated tax payments. Think of it kind of the same way. But then there is a yearly true-up on March 31. So to the extent that there were any, if the producer estimated and got 95% of the tax, well, the rest of the tax is due. But there is a safe harbor, and I see that as being sort of a taxpayer-friendly, reasonable thing to do. And again, as been previously noted, this would have an effective date of July 1st of 06. Did you have anything else?
I had a question. The safe harbor 90%, is that that 90% and no interest due on that, or would there be interest due on the tax months that would be underestimated?
Representative Sheehan, through the chair, if you paid 90% in any month, there would be no tax due when you paid the additional 10% on the March 31st true update. But if you only paid 85%, then you would, in fact, owe interest on the difference between 85 and 90. If I might just to carry, I mean, the notion is it's a monthly tax. However, a lot of the costs, because we're looking at the Internal Revenue Code, are going to be annualized costs, for example, capital credits. And so the notion is the ability to figure out when you're paying in January and February, you can certainly make estimates about how much you're going to be spending later on, but not with the same kind of certainty as you might be able to if you'd actually spent them. So that's why there's a difference between those two numbers.
Just to follow up, so this isn't a safe harbor from penalty, this is a safe harbor from penalty and interest.
Representative to the chair, that's correct. I mean, the penalty gets to a whole different thing about willful neglect of the statutes. This simply says if you pay that amount, then you're not subject to interest.
Any other questions? Page 14.
And the next slide talks about the transition provision, and this is the one that I mentioned earlier, which gives recognition to recent investments that the producers have made. Now, one might say, well, how is this going to work? Well, what you have when you buy an asset, a piece of equipment for the slope, again, harkening back to what I mentioned earlier, you will get 100% write-off in year one. Well, what that means then is the assets that were invested in last year, for example, they're getting no representation in the calculation of net income. Those assets are producing income for a number of years over their life, and yet if they were purchased last year, they aren't represented. So what is proposed then in the bill is to allow basically cost recovery of the assets that were placed in service in the previous 5 years, and those deductions would be allowed over the first 6 years, transition years. But the deduction will only be available when the average price exceeds $40. So there is a price floor in there. But what this does then is recognize that you've got assets that are generating income that should be recognized basically as a deduction. So we are in effect allowing a depreciation deduction for those transition assets.
Okay, so if you're into years, let's say 5 and 6 going forward, and the average price of oil does not exceed $40, do they carry then forward into years 7 and 8?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And that provision is found in section 21, which starts on page 11, and you're looking for paren G, which is at page 15.
Chairman Rammers had a question.
Thank you. Will you, while you're making your presentations to us, not right now, but the three majors, Conoco, BP, and ExxonMobil, have all chosen to explore and reinvest in our state, in our industry, between 7-1 and June of this year, different rates. Will you be able to monetize that per producer so we have an indication for each of the producers who will benefit most from this transition provision, and also the indicative of who has invested the most over the last 5 or 6 years? Is that something that revenue can do?
Representative Remmers, I'm trying to think. We have publicly available information, but it doesn't break it down. Let me back up. We back into certain of the information. If I can get narrow technical accounting here for a minute. ConocoPhillips reports segment accounting, so they report a set of numbers in their 10-Ks and their annual reports, and we use that to sort of gross up, given their ownership in various fields, sort of come with overall numbers. We can certainly present that, and that would give you some sense. As for things like exploration and things that occur outside of the that process, that would be taxpayer confidential information.
Let me follow up, Mr. Yeah. Chair. Who then does the transition provision benefit? Why is it there, and who does it benefit most, and who does it benefit least?
Through the chair, the taxpayer who will get the greatest benefit is the taxpayer who's made the largest investment. The taxpayer who's made no investment will get no benefit from it.
Well, we're really only talking about three taxpayers. That's what right. I'm asking, which taxpayers benefit the most, which right. benefit the least.
I think you can look and see, it's publicly known, Exxon owns roughly a 36% share of the Prudhoe Bay unit, a little bit over a third, and it has minor holdings in other units, but essentially that's the main stake that it's holding. ConocoPhillips has roughly the same share in Prudhoe Bay, and also owns a majority of both Kuparuk and Alpine Field, so they will have higher investments. BP owns a much smaller piece of Prudhoe Bay, but also has holdings in Milne Point, North Star.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. Just going back to the title of your presentation, current production tax and why it is a problem. So what I want to ascertain is who's been the problem over these last 5.5 years. We're trying to stimulate exploration, which presumes that there's a lack of exploration. This transition provision assumes that somebody benefits more, somebody benefits less. Who benefits more? Who benefits less?
The two major fields that have opened up in the last 5 years were North Star, that was owned is owned by BP, and Alpine, which is owned, 78% by ConocoPhillips. So those will be two large investments that will probably figure prominently in this calculation.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and I'll ask the same question of industry, and I know they're probably watching or listening right now, so I'll give them a couple days to get their answer together. A cost that got incurred for them 3 years ago, it's probably been recovered by now at $60 a barrel. I mean, it could be argued that, and I understand that when they made an investment 4 years ago, they counted on a rate of return and a net present value on that investment based on ELF, and I understand the business side of it, but the flip side of it is, as it went up, the recovery should have been there. So with that argument, that because of the high oil prices, you know, if we were at $30 a barrel, I think it would really, I would
really make sense to look at this, because they would have calculated their rate of return and their MPV and all of the economic models that they go through. But with a high price scenario, does it still make as much sense to have this transition in here? Or as a policy level, what does the administration think that you should have policy moving forward at any price level? If you're going to allow them to recover their costs, allow them to recover their costs and let the price do what it will. So just on a philosophical level, what do you think? And also just for the members, I'm assuming that we can probably be out of here on your schedule to go down the hall in 15, 20 minutes here. I'm hoping. So.
If I could attempt to answer you, Mr. Chairman, I am no economist. I am an accountant. And so I look at things slightly differently than economists do. And certainly we'll have economists here tomorrow that have thought about these things sort of inside out and backwards. But in the accounting world, if you buy a piece of machinery and it has a life of 10 years, you recognize that machinery is going to be, in effect, yielding positive net flow of income for 10 years. And so you sort of recognize, in a simple world, one-tenth of a year of the cost. Now, just because you had a windfall in year two, all of a sudden there was high demand for your product or whatever, doesn't change your view that in year five that asset is still producing net income and should be offset against that. So I think it's really from a sort of accounting perspective, not we have windfall sort of oil prices right now and that sort of cost recovery, but more from an accounting, this asset is generating net income each year. So I think that it's that perspective that is being looked at. I certainly welcome, again, clarification from our economists tomorrow to explore that a little bit further. But I would just offer that at this time.
Okay, we'll ask them as well as all the industry members that are listening right now. We will be asking them also.
And I wanted to ask the same question, kind of, but from a different tax perspective, and that is, Mr. Dickinson, on your earlier presentation, you gave us where ELF really spiraled down. 2001 happened to be the date in which ELF dropped so fast below, production and everything. That's this graph here, and it seems like when ELF basically stopped functioning the way it was anticipated. And haven't those costs actually been recovered by under the tax regime of ELF not functioning that way and the way it was originally intended and with this free fall of ELF? Hasn't that recovered these costs?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, you could certainly make an argument if you were looking at, again, capital cost recovery in a sense of gross cash flows, that the ELF provided a large window that allowed that. I think another way to think about that as Robin described is just looking at it as profit, that we're taxing profits, and these assets will be contributing to those profits over the next 10 years, regardless of how much profits have been captured over them in the past. And so we're trying to create a situation where there is some recognition of that, their contribution to the profits going forward.
I guess just on the tax structure and trying to figure out on the net profits, I mean, everything that's been invested up there is in the same structure. I mean, what is the magic? I mean, 2001 happened to be where ELF freefall, but it doesn't have any, I mean, why is investments in 2000 or 1999, why are those not still producing assets and having the same relationship to, oh, well, we're going to change the tax structure, so we should go back and recapture all of the investments. I mean, I don't understand the transition tying back to 2001.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I will tell you on transition rules, especially between any tax change, that there's a degree of arbitrariness in it. Could have been two, that could have been 4 years, could have been 5 years, could have been recovered over seven. Sure, it's an absolute fair point. This is what the governor's recommending.
Okay. Could you get a question?
No, it was basically along the same lines as Representative Seaton, okay. Was part of the fallout of the crisis bias system.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Senator?
Yep. Thanks, Mr. Chair. You know, it's going to be a really unusual request, but I'm deadly curious, and I don't know if you can do it. If you were the oil companies making a presentation here, I'd love to see a presentation that said, you're an oil company or the oil companies as a group, here are the charts, not the charts for the state to show how this PPT affects the state, but to show some charts also as to how the PPT affects the oil companies. Our profits will crash, our profits will hardly make a difference, etc. Is that something that's doable?
I doubt if you want to speak for industry.
I believe you'll get many charts with many crashes and drain effects
on them. On Monday and Tuesday.
And I knew that. What I'm looking for is the way you see the same picture.
Actually,
tell us how your picture is. Can you tell us how their picture is?
Representative, the chair. That's correct. And in fact, I think Roger Marks will be presenting some slides that talk about the change in take, who's getting what under the old, who's getting what under the new. So I think that's something that he will be focused on, because clearly, I mean, we try to understand that viewpoint as well.
Representative Jewell.
No.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Wilson.
Okay, and just to recap, then, additional revenue from the PPT will depend primarily on two factors, the price of the oil or gas and the producer investment in the state. So this was the big picture. And now I'm going to present just three slides of charts, because you're going to get lots of charts tomorrow. What I've done is taken the revenue forecast numbers right off of our fiscal notes for three price scenarios, and given you the charts just for those three price scenarios. Again, the economist will, you know, give you a number of scenarios, but I thought it might be helpful just to give you three fairly simple ones. This first one is the incremental revenue based on Department of Revenue forecast of price. In our fall sources book, you know, we publish the expected prices twice a year. You know, they're pretty conservative numbers. So consequently, our long-term forecast is 2550, right? Okay. So this is sort of, as I view it, kind of worst case scenario. And you'll see those numbers in the fiscal note. This, again, just puts it in a graph form. And the significance of the two lines, the blue line is the tax under the status quo system. And the pink line is the projected PPT. It does not.
This is a 2550 West Coast?
This is.
Our wellhead.
This is 2020, right off of our fiscal note, which I'll present here in a minute.
Wait, Representative Samuels, with the chart. I believe the first 2 years are not at 2550, and that's what the sort of the bump on the left hand side of the graph is. But thereafter, it is at 2550.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And as you can see in the long range forecast, I think kicks in 2009, and that's where it dips below the status quo. Again, I want to sort of present, hopefully, worst case scenario. And then the next slide shows sort of today's oil prices, which are the numbers that are.
Go back to the last chart, please.
Sure.
Let me just ask you, the charts that Mr. Van Meers gave out a few weeks ago showed that under a 2020 system, we would make less money under a 2020 system than the current system at about $27 a barrel. Now you're showing it roughly even at $25 a barrel. Have you changed any of your inputs since then, or are you using the same forecasted production amounts, tax amounts, as were used in that first presentation?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, the modeling that Dr. Van Mieris uses is he looks at five scenarios, five different size fields, plugs in all the parameters, and then generates what would happen in those five fields. What this analysis does is look at the North Slope per se, and is running those factors through it. And so it's looking at not a set of theoretical fields, but it's looking at the North Slope as it's portrayed in our forecast.
Thank you. Okay. And as I said a moment ago, the second chart shows today's oil prices and the fiscal impact at $60 oil. And the third, sort of a moderate, in between $40 a barrel oil. Again, the numbers off the fiscal note. And so that concludes my presentation on the overview of the PPT. And if there are no further questions on that, then I will walk through the fiscal note. Okay, very quickly, I won't read all of the information on the fiscal note. It presents revenues at three price levels, first being the Department of Revenue forecast, second being price of $40 and a price of $60. It shows the tax with the current system, that is status quo, the tax generated by the bill, and then calculated the gain from the bill. In terms of expenditures, what we see is some increase in expenditures for audit. While we will place less emphasis on auditing marine expenses and transportation expenses in general, it will still be true that we'll have a lot of auditing on expenses. In addition, the transition deduction, we will have all of the investments over the last 5 years to audit here pretty quickly because those will be starting to be deducted immediately. So we will have pretty heavy upfront costs for which we are planning to do outsourcing some contract auditing on the transition assets. And then for actual positions going forward, an additional three auditors plus a tax technician for the additional filings that will occur. So that is the four positions that are listed here. In addition to contract auditing on the transition assets, this shows contractuals that will include outside help for regulation writing, particularly as we recognize that the regulation writing will be on an expedited basis for an effective date of 7/1. So we're going to need some outside help on that, and then some basic programming to capture the new information coming in on the tax returns. So that's sort of the overview of the fiscal note. And
any questions on the fiscal notes? Okay, I'd like to just make a couple of clarifications, and I guess apologies to all of the members. We won't hurry through this. We'll make sure that everybody, particularly the Resource Committee members, have all of your questions answered. I realize that these people have to go down the hall and do the same presentation at the Senate right now. But if we have to go an extra day or two, or if we take an extra week in this committee or the next committee, I don't want to be rushing along or act like I did not want any of the debate of any of the members here. So as we go down the road, I'm going to try to stick to the schedule, but if you don't get questions, just stop me. Also, if it's okay with the two of you,
is after you've gone through and digested this with the members, if you want something answered, it probably behooves you to email it to Mr. Dickinson and Ms. Wilson here, and you get a better answer in a shorter period of time and not take the committee time up, where you can make the presentation go, here's a question from Representative Samuels, and here's the answer, and here's the policy choice you'll have to make. So if you can get to them tonight or tomorrow night, as we go down the road here, we can do that. We can bring the administration back, if the committee so chooses to, after the industry has come in. Industry will be here Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. We can do whatever the committee chooses to do. We've got a schedule set up. We'd like to at least try to stick to it. And I appreciate the members' indulgence on that today. I appreciate the presentation. Representative, do you have a question?
Yeah, I just had one. Could you prepare another slide like the last one, but it's $18 or $20, so we can see it below the effect of PPP versus our current tax bill below? Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Guerra.
Thank you. And could I ask this? Tell me if it would not be feasible, but I would like to see the charts that you provided comparing current law to the PPT system. You did it under the scenario of a 2020 PPT tax. Could I see what it would be under three other scenarios, 30-15, 30-20, and 25-20?
30-15, 30-20, and 30.
And 25-20, you know, what the governor proposed last week.
And I would expect that would be part of the economic presentation tomorrow.
Okay.
That's okay.
Okay, if there's no other business tomorrow, 12:30, same place. Thank you, Representative Meyer, for the use of the room. We're adjourned. Thank you.